Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off with a clip from Chris Wallace speaking at the Newseum this week in Washington, D.C. And he talks about freedom of the press and the freedom right to speak freely. And right to free speech is what he was talking about. And this is about an 8-minute clip. This is just part of his total speech. But nowhere did I hear in there anything about the problems of Operation Mockingbird that the CIA set up early on in the 50s to and start manipulating the various high levels of the United States press, U.S. press. And neither did I hear from him the consolidation of the media that has occurred over the last few decades, which has made is boiled it down to 5 or 6 gigantic conglomerates that control much of our press and our media. And I believe he's very critical of President Trump, and I think it's unrightfully so. It's unfair, his criticism, when actually the people are beginning to wake up to what President Trump is describing as fake news. So Chris Wallace is on the wrong side of history, and he's not with the people in on this issue. So here we go with Chris Wall speaking at the Newseum this week.
I want to talk a little bit this evening about the First Amendment, but also the challenges to the First Amendment and the challenges inside the news business. A lot of people come up to me these days and say how fair I am. Some even say that I'm a voice of reason, which those twins and my other children find absolutely hilarious. Now, don't get me wrong. I like compliments as much as the next guy, but I find this particular compliment kind of depressing. Why? Because when I started in the news business a half century ago, working as a reporter for the Boston Globe, fairness was not something to be singled out. It was the basic minimum requirement for your job. People might praise you for your reporting or for your writing or later for how you were on the air, but fairness was what kept you from getting fired. Now it stands out. This is something that I think all of us in the news business need to think about, need to take very seriously. I believe that President Trump is engaged in the most direct, sustained assault on freedom of the press in our history. And I will get to that in a moment. Before you applaud, listen to the rest of this. Because I think many of our colleagues in the news business see the president's attacks, his constant bashing of the media, as a rationale, as an excuse to cross the line themselves to push back. And that is a big mistake. I see it all the time on the front page of major newspapers and the lead of the evening news. Fact mixed with opinion. Buzzwords like bombshell and scandal. The animus of the reporter and the editor as plain to see as the headline. 2 days after Donald Trump was elected president, 2 days, this was the sentence in the lead story in the New York Times. The American political establishment reeled on Wednesday as leaders in both parties began coming to grips with 4 years of President Donald J. Trump in the White House, a once unimaginable scenario that has now plunged the United States and its allies into a period of deep uncertainty about the policies and impact of this administration. There's a lot to unpack in that one sentence. It hasn't stopped since. I know this is going to be controversial, but I came here today from having spent all day at Fox News covering the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the IG report. Some things in the report, very supportive of what the FBI did. Some of it very critical. We covered it all. One of our fellow networks, CNN, today ignored the IG report, ignored all of the statements about terrible misconduct, perhaps illegality on the part of the FBI in its seeking of the FISA warrants against Carter Page. Now, the last time I checked, CNN was pretty interested in the Russia investigation, but they didn't seem interested in this. The fact is, to be clear, the president has given us plenty to work with, but when we respond to him like that, when we respond with bias, we're playing his game, not ours. We are not participants in what we cover. We are umpires or observers trying to be objective witnesses to what is going on. If the president or anyone we're covering says something untrue or does something questionable, we can and should report it. But we shouldn't be drawn into the fight. We shouldn't be drawn into taking sides, as tempting as that is. We're not as good at it as they are, and we're abandoning the special role the founders gave us in this democracy. Now, let's talk about the president. He has done everything he can to undercut the media, to try to delegitimize us. And I think his purpose is clear, to raise doubts when we report critically about him and his administration, that we can be trusted. Back in 2017, he tweeted something that said far more about him than it did about us. Quote, "The fake news media is not my enemy. It is the enemy of the American people." After that statement, retired Admiral Bill McRaven, a Navy SEAL for 37 years, the man in charge of the missions that captured Saddam Hussein and that took down Osama bin Laden, Bill McRaven said this, quote, "This sentiment may be the greatest threat to democracy in my lifetime." Now, I got to say, I was a little surprised by that. Remember, this is a guy who fought the Soviet Union. This is an admiral who fought Islamic terrorism. But when I asked Bill about this, this was his response. "Those threats, the Soviets, Islamic terrorism, those threats brought us together. Both the president and I swore an oath to the Constitution. And the First Amendment to that Constitution is freedom of the press. When the president says the media is the enemy of the people, to me that undermines the Constitution. So I do think it is a tremendous threat to our democracy." Let's be honest. The president's attacks have done some damage. A Freedom Forum Institute poll associated here with the Newseum this year found that 29% of Americans, almost a third of all of us, think the First Amendment goes too far. And 77%, three-quarters, say that fake news is a serious threat to our democracy. But on this night, as we celebrate freedom of the press and we commemorate the Newseum, I think we should remember some essential truths. First, ours is a great profession, maybe the best that anybody ever thought of as a way to make a living. Think of it. We get paid to tell the truth. How many people can say that? To cut through all the spin, all the distractions, and to tell the American people what is really going on. What our leaders are really doing. What's happening in our schools, and in our hospitals, in our neighborhoods, and with our environment. I have been blessed to do this for 50 years. I spent a week with Mother Teresa in Calcutta just after she'd won the Nobel Peace Prize. I covered President Reagan for 6 years, going with him to China and the Korean DMZ and covering four Reagan-Gorbachev summits. Last year, I interviewed Vladimir Putin in Helsinki just after that summit, and I asked him, "Why do so many of the people who oppose you end up dead?" And I live to tell the tale. Sure, we take our share of incoming. A couple of weeks ago, President Trump tweeted after one of my interviews, "Steve Scalise blew away the nasty and obnoxious Chris Wallace." Afterwards, one of my sons said, "Nasty? No. Obnoxious? Well..." The bottom line is we have seen presidents come and go. We will endure. So will freedom of the press. And so, I am confident, will the Newseum. Thank you all so much.
I didn't hear just thunderous applause after Chris Wallace had ended his speech. sounded like pretty light clapping to me. So people are catching on to this fake news stuff. When you have gigantic social media cutting back, taking off conservative newscasters, and actually censoring, and they're not really regulated. They're not regulated right now. And so there'd have to be some kind of antitrust action to try to level up the playing field. But people are just, Chris Wallace is just out of touch right now. What we have coming up next is an interview on the Tucker Carlson Show by Kilmeade. He interviewed two people there, Jim Jordan and Mike Johnson, both representatives. And these are some of the ideas and views that they had of what went on this week in this these impeachment hearings. Here we go now. First, Jim Jordan, and then secondly, Mike Johnson.
All right. What about the mastermind behind all this? What about Adam Schiff? How is he being said? Well, no, he was quite serious on a comedy show, the Stephen Colbert Show. He gave a speech worthy of an Oscar. Let's listen together.
And I wonder how they're going to explain one day when their grandchild comes to them and says, Granddad, Grandmom, please tell me what you did when that unethical man, that terrible man that was putting people in cages, dividing our country, extorting our allies, please tell me what you did to stand up to that man. What will their answer be? For all too many, it will be nothing. It will be nothing except shame.
Right. The people in cages, should we just outline it? That was President Obama. I don't think it's right to say that about President Obama and bring that up. I also think it's important to say that man that added 266,000 jobs last month is working on a series of free trade agreements that should put us, catapult the economy to another generation, that's doing the best to keep us out of wars. But a lot of kids don't really want to talk about sports. They do want to talk about international affairs, especially grandchildren. He probably rehearsed that one or a few times in a mirror. President Trump, for his part, is treating all this the same way he treated the Russia investigation.
So the impeachment is a hoax. It's a sham. It started a long time ago, probably before I came down the escalator with the future First Lady. Started a long time ago. So look, we're dealing with a lot of corrupt people. There was nothing done wrong. To use the power of impeachment on this nonsense is an embarrassment to this country.
Abuse of power, obstruction of Congress. Those are the two articles. It'll be on the floor on Wednesday after the rules looks at it on Tuesday. Congressman Jim Jordan, you no longer have to sit in that seat and stare straight ahead and give speeches without a jacket on. Are you solemn today? What do you think the real feeling among Democrats is?
Well, who knows? I mean, we'll know the real feeling next November when the American people get to decide. But the whole thing was ridiculous. I mean, this is really about what Nancy Pelosi said 3.5 weeks ago when she called the President of the United States an imposter. They have never accepted, Brian, the fact that 63 million of us voted for this guy to come to this town and drain the swamp, won an electoral college landslide. They've never accepted that fact, and they've been looking for any way and every way to take him out of this town and take him out of office, and now it comes down to impeachment. When all the facts are on the president's side, they don't care because they've never accepted the will of the American people.
How would you characterize what you went through? I saw a group of people talking at each other, not to each other, not listening at all. You did not engage each other, so nothing was done. I felt as though the American people were bored to tears or they hit mute, no offense.
Yeah. No, I get that, but again, they won't accept the facts. Four facts have never changed. They will never change. They've always been there. We have the transcript. There was no quid pro quo in the transcript. We have the two guys who were on the call, President Trump, President Zelensky. Both have said no pressure, no pushing, no linkage of an investigation to the security assistance money. We have the fact Ukraine didn't even know aid was paused at the time of the call. And most importantly, Ukraine took no action, i.e. never made any announcement of investigation into anybody, let alone the Bidens, to get the aid released. Those facts have always been there, but they don't care because they've never accepted the will of the people. And Brian, they know they can't beat President Trump next November. Remember, in 2016, they had the insurance policy when they spied on four American citizens associated with President Trump's campaign. In 2020, they're trying impeachment to hopefully give themselves a chance to have a chance to compete against the president next fall. It's not going to work. President Trump's going to win because of his amazing record.
So since the Democrats and Republicans don't really talk to each other, and certainly not to Adam Schiff, I'm going to try to be the go-between. Let's answer Adam Schiff's questions. What are you going to say to your grandchildren when they ask you, why didn't you do anything to stop that horrible man?
We defended the facts. We defended the truth. We defended President Trump. And in the 3 years he's been president, taxes cut, regulations reduced, economy growing at an unbelievable pace. You just had some of the numbers from last month, 260,000 jobs. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the court, out of the Iran deal. Embassy is now in Jerusalem. Hostages home from North Korea. And today marks one of the greatest trade days for our country. We're going to get a new USMCA, new NAFTA next week. We're getting a new agreement with China. And, oh, by the way, the president said he's going to work with Boris Johnson to get a new agreement with Great Britain. Those are the kind of things he's getting done, and that's why he's going to win next November.
We're also getting a space force. Lastly, real quick, Congressman Jordan, when you look at this whole thing in its entirety, and you look at Brexit, Brexit gets passed, they don't accept it, nothing happens. President Trump wins an election, they don't accept it, they fight the whole time. Do you see a parallel?
Yeah, well, certainly. When you have people coming in and taking on the establishment, trying to drain the swamp, standing up for we the people, the American people, the hardworking folks like I know in Ohio, union workers, hard union workers, hardworking people in Ohio, families across this country, that makes this town go crazy. But this president's fighting for the very people he told him that he was going to fight for, doing what he said he was going to do.
Well, I can tell you're a wrestler because you just worked for 36 out of the last 48 hours. You don't even look tired because you put the training in. Congressman, thanks so much for spending part of your Friday night with us.
You bet, Brian. Thank you for all you do.
You got it. Meanwhile, straight ahead. After impeachment, it will be Mitch McConnell's job to oversee a trial in the Senate. But Democratic Representative Val Demings says McConnell has to recuse himself because he could not take an oath to be impartial. Congressman Mike Johnson represents Louisiana. Not many people knew about the congressman from Louisiana, outside Louisiana, before these series of national hearings, but we know you now. Congressman, what's your reaction to this new push? To get Mitch McConnell to recuse himself because he says he's going to go to the White House to find out what they want to do with this trial.
Well, I think it's absurd. Look, Mitch McConnell made a couple of comments in the last 24 hours acknowledging the very obvious truth about all this, that everybody in the country now has seen the record, they've seen the facts, they've seen what supposedly is backing up these articles of impeachment, and there's nothing there. Professor Turley said it so well, the only expert we've been allowed on the Republican side in this whole charade in the Judiciary Committee, he said it's the thinnest record in the history of impeachments in this country on the weakest charges. There's nothing there. We systematically destroyed their case 14 hours of that hearing yesterday, and everybody can see it, and Mitch McConnell can as well.
So there's two schools of thought, and the president seems to be back off his original thought. But I do talk radio as well. Everybody on talk radio that seems to side with the president wants to see a trial, a chance to bring up Joe Biden, Adam Schiff, and others to get the president's side of the story out, that the Ukraine was up to no good in 2016, that there might have been something else going on while Russia was also up to no good in 2016. Are you somebody that believes to adequately tell this whole story, you should go ahead and try to prove the thesis the president had?
Look, I was with the president this evening. I understand his sentiment. He wants his side of the case to be put out there, and I do too. Many of us, his supporters and those who believe in the rule of law. He's been railroaded here. He did not get due process, and he should have a right to get his witnesses and the other side of the story out there. But I also understand the rationale of getting this through the Senate quickly. You know, there's an alternative here. We could look into what still remains out there about Ukraine and these scandals and all the unanswered questions. It could be done in a simple investigation through the Senate Judiciary Committee under Lindsey Graham as the chairman. So there are multiple ways to get at that. We may be able to avoid a full trial in the Senate.
Right.
I think everybody knows now the case is so weak it will go away and be dispensed with pretty quickly.
So what was the president's attitude like?
The president's in a very good mood today because he sees what's happening. Look, this is going to backfire on the Democrats, as we all warned them and told them, expected. The polling is moving in the direction of the president. He's up a measurable amount in a lot of the swing states now. And these Democrats who are elected in these swing districts are in big trouble. I mean, there's going to be a big political price to be paid. At the end of the day, though, Brian, as we said in our closing yesterday, it's not just the political price, the just political price the Democrats are going to have to pay. There's a price that the whole country pays for this charade that has been perpetuated on the people because they've opened a Pandora's box. A single party impeachment is something that the founders of this country warned against because they knew it would divide us, and that's what we have now.
Never had before. 2317 out of committee. How many Democrats do you think will not vote for impeachment?
You know, we're hearing it'll be at least a handful, maybe 10, maybe a dozen. I don't know. We'll see how it plays out over the next few days. A lot of them went home for the weekend. They're going to hear it from their constituents. And I tell you, these 31 that are from these swing districts that Trump won, they're in some real jeopardy right now. They better think long and hard about it.
It's going to be really interesting because we're in an election year, and a lot of those men and women got in about a year ago promising to get something done. I don't know if this was what the constituents had in mind. Congressman Johnson, now go enjoy your weekend, okay?
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
All right. Meanwhile, here we go.
Next, we have Dan Bongino on the Fox and Friends, and this Saturday morning. So here's what he has to say about what's going on up there in Washington.
In the meantime, impeachment, captivating the nation, one might say, Dan, maybe not in a good way for Democrats. We've decided to look back a little bit at Adam Schiff. And something that people have passed over, when he was first running for Congress, he went against Republican incumbent Jim Rogan, who you remember was one of the prosecutors basically in the Clinton impeachment. And Schiff said, I think impeachment for most people in this district is only the most graphic illustration of an incumbent who has put the national partisan ideological fights ahead of representing his district. People want to decide this on the basis of who's going to serve our community. Do you think the Trump campaign should take that and use that as a template for their ads? Let's get something done, folks.
Yeah, I would say that, Ed, under normal circumstances. But the thing with Schiff is you have to triage his lies, right? Like, is this lie that he's a hypocrite on impeachment? Where does this rank on Schiff's lies? Like, his lies are so profound, I honestly think there are better Schiff lies to use against him. And this may be the least of Schiff's lies. I mean, think about it. He's only lied and gotten busted, nailed to the wall, on three of the biggest lies possibly of our generation. Schiff told us and swore that Spygate was a total hoax. He was wrong. He told us collusion was real, and he had evidence. He was wrong. He initiates an impeachment against the president, says, we had no contact with this whistleblower. He was wrong. This guy's a liar. And even worse, he attacked people who told the truth. Remember when he verbally attacked Devin Nunes for the Nunes memo? Mm-hmm. Well, now we have the IG report, and we find out Devin Nunes' memo was absolutely right, and Schiff's memo was a total fraud. So in the history of Schiff's lies, this is like number 22.
Well, there's so many you can't keep track. I mean, 9 months ago he said it had to be bipartisan, otherwise it was divisive. He started the committee hearing by reading from a transcript that was totally made up about the phone call. I mean, it never ends with this guy. No wonder the numbers are where they are.
Pete, and the media never holds him to account. I mean, think about it. Why are they still having this guy on and take him seriously? I mean, in normal times, this guy, I'm not kidding, would be a pariah in his party. He is on tape saying openly, I have evidence of collusion. Mm-hmm. He was on Fox News, on Tucker Carlson, looking into the camera. I have evidences. He had none. He made the whole thing up. He has a memo we can all still read in the media, the Schiff memo, about how the dossier was substantive, how that's not the only thing the FBI uses. It was all a lie. It was an Aesop's fable. It was made up, and the media still takes this guy seriously. If that was a Republican, Pete, who had Schiff's record of profound dishonesty, he would be laughed off the air. Mm-hmm. But he's welcomed with open arms in his D+23 district in California.
He's
He'll get reelected
chairman
handily.
Of the committee. Matter. He's also chairman of a committee. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Powerful committee. You're right.
I'm going to move to a topic here, Dan, that I think is probably one that will resonate with you, and that's what's happening at Starbucks. Now, we know that it was a little while ago that there was an officer who went in to get a cup of coffee, and they wrote pig on the cup to name him. And now we have another incident where officers were, you know, sort of not given service while they went to go get or refuse service, I guess, when they went into a Starbucks. So now we have another incident. Here's what the Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco had to say about this. He said two of our deputies were refused service at Starbucks. The anti-police culture repeatedly displayed by Starbucks employees must end. We've been talking about this, Dan, during the show. I brought up the fact that, hey, Starbucks shut down the store, all of them, over, a racial incident. It just seems like their response is a little weak.
Yeah, Starbucks better clean this up. I mean, this is really disgusting. You know, I was on the air here on Fox and Friends not that long ago, and I told just this quick story. I said, you know, Rachel, Pete, Ed, you guys are in the same business I am now. Can you imagine, right? Can you imagine getting up maybe once every 3 or 4 months and getting a text, and in that text finding out that one of your colleagues, God forbid, had died in the line of duty? You're like, well, what are you talking about? Well, I have a friend, a New York City police officer friend. He just retired a few weeks ago, actually. And I'm telling you, every 3 months, he texts me, and he'll text me about an NYPD cop either we went through the academy with, or we may have known, or may have worked with, or may not have. It doesn't really matter. Who's died in the line of duty? What other job in America do you get a text every few months about a colleague that literally died in the service of others? And you're going to write pig on their coffee mug? I mean, if you really thought this through, I mean, I don't want to get in the middle of your busy barista day. And believe me, I'm not disrespecting people who work hard at all. But I'm being serious. I don't want to get in the middle of your busy barista day here. But have you thought that through, that some kid's not going to have his dad in it probably next week, sadly, or the week after, because some police officer working for $40,000, $50,000 a year took one in the chest, responded to a call to help someone else? Yeah. I don't think you really thought that through in the middle of your busy barista day where you were busy writing pig on somebody's cup.
Well, to Rachel's point, Dan, might it be time for some retraining at Starbucks since we've seen incident after incident after incident? Maybe their employees should be taught to respect law enforcement?
Well, I think Rachel just nailed it right there. I mean, how about a day off there? How about a day off for a national training symposium on that? Like, hey, we don't disrespect law enforcement, our military, our first responders in our store, guys. Like, these are American patriots. And not only that, I mean, they're customers. These are customers, too. Yeah. But I don't think we'll see any of that.
I think they should bring you in, Dan, to do the training.
Oh, boy. I'm not sure you want
to. I'll do it. I'm down.
I'm not sure you want to see that. It might get a little tough.
He's
a tough guy, that Dan
Bongino.
You're
Bongino. Right. You know me well, Ed.
Dan, take care.
Thanks, Dan.
We appreciate you coming in.
You got it.
Merry Christmas.
Coming up next is Boris Johnson's speech that he made immediately after winning the majority in the parliament for the Conservative Tory Party. But here we go with Boris Johnson. He's a get up and go kind of guy. I like him.
You have changed the political landscape. You've changed the Conservative Party for the better, and you've changed the future of our country for the better.
Yeah.
All the people of Sedgefield, of Bishop Auckland, of Stockton South, Darlington, where my ancestors come from, it turns out, Northwest Durham, Blythe Valley, and Redcar. Because I want to thank all the people of those incredible constituencies, because I want to thank all of you for the trust that you have placed in us, in the Conservative Party, and in me. And I know how difficult it was, and it can be, to make that kind of decision. And I can imagine people's pencils hovering over the ballot paper and wavering before coming down for us in the Conservatives. And I know that people may have been breaking the voting habits of generations to vote for us. And I want the people of the North East to know that we in the Conservative Party and I will repay your trust. Everything that we do, everything I do as your Prime Minister, will be devoted to repaying that trust. And first of all, what I'll be going to do to repay to get Brexit done, aren't we? We're going to get Brexit done, and we have a deal ready to go. Now, can anybody tell me what kind of a deal it is? Can anybody give me? Give me the culinary characteristics of that deal again. It is oven ready. It's ready to go. Every single one of our wonderful MPs, our wonderful new MPs, they're all here. Now, do you support that deal? They do. They all back it. And we have 100% support. We can get it in before Christmas. We've just been going over the timetable. We can definitely get in before Christmas, and then we're out on January the 31st. But there is much more that we want to do to repay the trust of the British people and the trust of the people here in the North East. We want, of course, to improve our fantastic National Health Service, and that's why we're making the biggest investments for a generation. How many new hospitals?
14.
How many new nurses? How many more nurses, I should say? 50,000. Yes, well, we will get on, and we will get on and liberal on those objectives. And we will make the streets safer across the whole of the UK by investing in how many more police initially? Absolutely, absolutely correct. And we will improve our education system. The money is already going in for every primary school, every secondary school in the country, 4,000 per pupil in the primary, 5,000 per pupil in the secondary schools. And what we want to do as Conservatives, and we want to take our country forward, we want to do it by uniting and levelling up across the whole of our incredible United Kingdom. And we do it with a very simple idea. It's by investing in better infrastructure, better education, and fantastic modern technology. And give those things to every part of the United Kingdom. And we will spread opportunity across the whole of the United Kingdom. Because that is fundamentally what we in the Conservative Party believe in. We believe in giving opportunity everywhere. We believe that talent is evenly distributed throughout our country, but opportunity is unfairly distributed. And we are going to rectify that as a one-nation Conservative government, as a people's government. That is what we are going to do. And finally, I want to say something to my colleagues, my newly elected MP colleagues. And I want to say, in all sincerity to you in the North East, thank you very much. But thank you, colleagues, for what you have done in your campaigns. I think they've all been excellent. And I congratulate you on your achievement. And you're all going to come down now with me on Monday to Westminster. I don't know when you start setting up, but you've got to come down. We're all going to be there on Monday. And we're going to do some fantastic things. Our country's now embarked on a wonderful adventure. And we're going to recover our national self-confidence, our mojo, our self-belief. And we're going to do things differently and better as a country, because we can. We'll have some fantastic opportunities. I see Mayor Houchin over there. We're going to look at free trade, different and better regulation, cutting national insurance contributions, doing all sorts of things differently and better. And it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful time for our country, I hope. And our country will stand tall in the world. But I want to say to all of my colleagues as MPs, when we get down to Westminster and we begin our work, remember, we are not the masters. We are the servants now. We are the servants now. Yes. And our job is to serve the people of this country and to deliver on our priorities. And our priorities and their priorities are the same. And of course, they're getting Brexit done. But it is also delivering on our national health service, our education, safer streets, better hospitals, a better future for our country. That is what we are going to deliver. That is what we are going to focus on. Thank you all very much for your time. Thank you for coming along this morning. Thank you for your wonderful achievement in transforming our party, transforming the political map of this country, and I think putting Britain on a brighter, better path. Thank you all very much for coming. At this stage in the election campaign, which is now over, I don't think I'm required to take any questions. But I'm going to go and talk briefly to the media, and then I'm going to go back and start thinking about what we're all going to do. Thank you very much, everyone.
William Barr was interviewed just recently on Big Tech on this antitrust type of problems that these big companies, these big social network companies are having. Here we go with that interview, and then I'll make some comments at the end.
More now from my interview with Attorney General William Barr. Earlier this year, the Justice Department announced a major investigation of big technology firms over antitrust. And I asked him when that investigation might be wrapped up.
We started in earnest in July. It's been moving very quickly. We have a very ambitious schedule, and things are keeping up to schedule. We're talking very broadly with people and getting a lot of input from people in the industry and experts and so forth. And we're doing our analysis. And, you know, I'd like to have it completed sometime next year. I think it's important to move quickly on things. That's something I can talk about later. But, you know, these things have a cost to the marketplace and to the businesses. And I think at some point the government has to fish or cut bait.
What are the principles here at stake? I mean, obviously bigness alone is not, I mean, these are enormous companies. They dominate their sectors. They dominate the U.S. Economy and the markets in this way. But that it's well established that scale alone
that is not sufficient to warrant antitrust enforcement action, or even to raise necessarily concerns about unfair behavior. So what would be the principle, without getting into it again, what are the concerns about what Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, maybe others are doing?
Well, let me just say, our review is not just limited to antitrust. The antitrust obviously is front and center. But there are also other concerns relating to these companies that other laws might apply to. There's some pressure, or some people have suggested, sort of strong-arming the antitrust laws in order to reach things that really were not intended to be covered by the antitrust laws. And I'm not really in line with that. You know, I don't mind updating, you know, making sure that we're properly applying the antitrust laws to new situations, but we are looking at antitrust. We're also looking at behavior across the board and how it implicates other laws. The problem, obviously, is big, and I said this in my confirmation hearing, you know, big is not bad. I work for Verizon, and I really appreciate that. But the question is, when you have the kind of market power that some companies have in their market, then some conduct which may have made sense when they were sort of the insurgent company in a growing industry can become anti-competitive because it ends up fortifying the monopoly. And so there's conduct that has grown up in these businesses that we have to take a look at and see the extent to which it really involves maintaining a monopoly. Also, you know, this is particularly true where you have a powerful network effects like you do in these sectors. The other thing is that these are businesses that operate in multiple sub-markets, and you have to do a lot of thinking about how they potentially are leveraging power in one into another, and also the role that data plays in that.
So a couple of the issues, again, you may or may not want to comment on them, but some of the things that people have raised concerns about are things like, for example, bias in search results, that they could be, the algorithms could possibly, conceivably, be favoring either their own products or people who've paid or whatever. Is that a possibility? Is that something you're looking into?
Well, I can say exactly what we're looking into. I think Google has made public that they received civil investigative demands. But, you know, I think that's sort of apparent to everybody the kinds of practices that are, you know, potentially being looked
at. And that could be one. And what about the simple scale of the online advertising? Facebook and Google between them dominate online advertising. Is that in itself the scale that they have? Is that a source of concern and potential antitrust action?
Well, that goes to the market power, and then you have to look at particular practices that may essentially exclude other competitors and lock in their market power. As I said, just successfully competing and getting to a dominant position is not itself wrong.
So did you hear what William Barr said? Well, being a dominant position and a market power is not necessarily wrong. Well, that's unless they're using these algorithms in the background to manipulate elections. It's been alleged that some of these social networks did affect the midterms, and that's why perhaps the Republicans lost the House to the Democrats. That's been alleged. Those are real questions, and we've got to get a handle on this. We've got to guarantee people access to these networks with no constraints whatsoever or censoring of anything that they say on board there. If we don't reach some kind of unrestricted free speech type of protections on these social networks, then what they're doing now is they're just taking off conservatives or people they're calling hate speech, but actually the hate speech is being promulgated by the mainstream media. They're camouflaging it as the truth. But it's far from there. Coming up next is a interview with Lou Dobbs with John Solomon, and he's talking about the Carter Page and how the FBI mistreated Carter Page. That's who they used to open up this investigation and this surveillance of President Trump, even candidate Trump, before he went in office as president. Here we go with John Solomon.
Welcome back. The FBI declaring in a court filing that it has, are you ready? Absolutely no records of any disciplinary action taken against any bureau or attorneys who pursued the FISA warrants targeting the Trump campaign. This, despite the DOJ Inspector General's report that found 17 significant acts of misconduct, of false statements, and, well, omitted information. Joining us tonight, award-winning investigative reporter, Fox Business contributor, and the leading investigative reporter on Spygate and all attendant stories, John Solomon. John, good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Lou.
This is, it doesn't end with this story. It is corruption, more corruption, and more corruption in the Department of Justice and the FBI.
And now I think, thanks to the good work of the Southeastern Legal Foundation, one of the great public interest law firms in America, we now know the FBI, despite all the evidence that we know of wrongdoing in the FISA thing, they've not taken one iota of a step to try to discipline or hold accountable the people that brought this fraud upon the American public. And it's just extraordinary. It's a warning sign. If anyone's going to be punished, it's going to have to require the FISA court and Attorney General Barr and U.S. Attorney John Durham, because the Bureau and the DOJ bureaucracy will not discipline itself.
And based on what we've seen, though, John, the level of corruption in the FBI and environs, there's no reason to expect them to do the right thing. There is nothing noble about their leadership. I just can't imagine why we would expect anything of them responsible and ethical whatsoever based on what we now know about Spygate, the Crossfire Hurricane, the special counsel investigation. Yeah. It goes on and on.
Listen, there are so many great men and women in the FBI. I've been blessed to know them since I was a little boy growing up in a cop's home. There are great people in the Bureau who do great things every day, but the cultural mindset and the leadership of the last two leaders of this Bureau have left us with this mess. And if we don't fix it, all of us, not just Donald Trump and Carter Page, all of us are at risk of our liberties being violated with the sort of nonchalance and dishonesty that we saw in this case. This is about America now. This isn't about Donald Trump anymore. What sort of America are we going to live in? And are we going to live by a secret police that can do whatever they want, make up whatever issues they want? That's how serious this issue is.
And it's so serious that both parties, one of them that should have been at least keenly aware of the vulnerabilities and the corruption of those that department and that agency, reauthorized FISA until March. We'll just extend it 90 days so that people won't get their pretty heads, concerned about such a abstract issue as the FISA court that appears, by the way, to be, if not corrupt, incompetent. And I come down on corrupt. I really do, because it's just inconceivable to me that FISA courts can approve 99 point plus of all percent of all of the applications before them. It's a rubber stamp.
Yeah, and our court system was set up by our founding fathers to create an adversarial system so that our rights would be protected. And we have this now rubber stamp. And, you know, I sat back after reading the IG report for the third time this week, and I just thought about something. On January 4th, 2017, the FBI knew the Steele dossier was bunk when they interviewed his source who disowned all the information on that. 2.5 years of pain and suffering for Carter Page being falsely portrayed as a Russian stooge when he was a CIA asset. Donald Trump's presidency being held hostage by a false investigation. All of that could have been prevented if the American public knew what the FBI knew in real time. It is shameful that it left all of us in the dark for 2.5 years to suffer through this sad chapter. And someone, many people, should be held accountable for that misconduct.
I agree. I happen to be one of those, and I think you and I may disagree, but I believe Michael Horowitz was awfully gentle in that Inspector General report that he filed.
There's a lot of civility to it, but there also is a lot of facts that are damning. And I think in the beginning, having a factual basis to now disassemble all the lies we've been told for the last 2.5 years is still a public service. It's for us to interpret, and it's for us to hold accountable now, the people who did this.
Yeah, let's turn to Rudy Giuliani, president's personal attorney.
Sure.
Telling the president that his trip to Ukraine produced more than you can imagine, a source telling the Wall Street Journal. He says he says this. Let's just quote from the tweet. The American people have already made up their mind on this impeachment scam. This is a smokescreen for the Obama-Biden administration's corruption. It will soon be proven. And Giuliani says there will be a 20-page report. Your thoughts?
Yeah, listen, I think he's done a lot of research, and I think there's more important facts to come out. Next week, I expect to get my next documents from the State Department from the FOIA lawsuit that I pursued with the Southeastern Legal Foundation. We're going to learn more about Hunter Biden's contacts or his company's contacts with the State Department. We are not done digging on Ukraine. Any of us who've worked on it need to get to the truth because the mainstream media and our Congress hasn't shown that interest. There's a lot more to be learned there, and some of it's going to be troubling. And I think, I don't know exactly what the mayor has, but I believe that there's more serious misconduct to be divulged from Ukraine.
John Solomon, always great to hear from you. Great
Thanks,
to have
sir.
You on the broadcast. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
What's coming up next is Trey Gowdy, interviewed by Martha McCallum. And he's even saying that, you know, James Comey ought to quit writing books on ethics. Here we go with this. And Trey Gowdy's a stand-up guy, really, really good guy. So here we go with Trey Gowdy.
But first, I'm joined on set by former federal prosecutor and former Oversight Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy. Trey, always good to see you. Great to have you in New York tonight.
Thank you.
What do you think about the fact that places like the New York Times and the Rolling Stone are now essentially saying, you thought, holy God, what a clown show this whole thing was?
2 years too late. They vilified Devin. They vilified Paul. They vilified Cash Patel, Johnny Ratcliffe. Those of us who for 2 years have been saying we like the Department of Justice. We need a good Department of Justice. But what they did in 2016 and 2017 is just wrong. So I don't know what report Comey read. This is the third IG report that has found his conduct to be substandard. If that's a victory lap, if he wants to take a victory lap because he's not indicted, more power to him. Don't write any more books on ethics, though. Don't tell me what the ethical standard is if you think this report vindicates you.
Yeah. You know, as I have followed this story very closely, covered it for years, there were things that I learned in the past couple of days looking at this report, and I know that you were privy to a lot of this before it all came out. But, you know, just to sort of put a fine point on some of this, right, you've got Carter Page, who was in the Navy, then was an asset for the CIA, sort of a peripheral asset who gave them information over time. They sort of had a relationship. He was traveling and doing a lot of foreign events and giving them some information. So the FBI says to the CIA or to all the agencies, is this individual that we're looking at an asset of any of yours? And the CIA comes back and says, yeah, he's one of ours. They change it because they want to put a tail on this guy to not an asset. Right. Of the CIA. I mean, that is a travesty. How does that happen?
Wrong people doing the wrong job. It is the most damning part that came out of Horowitz. I did not know that an FBI lawyer, someone that we give incredible powers and authorities and therefore a corresponding responsibility to, would change someone's status. I mean, keep in mind, a counterintelligence investigation is because you think Carter Page is working on behalf of Russia. The reality is Carter Page was working on behalf of the United States of America, and you changed it from he is a source to he's not a source, which is a manifestly unfair thing to do to Carter Page. But so when Horowitz says there was no bias in the inception, there was no bias ab initio, there was a lot of bias from every point thereafter, including an FBI lawyer manufacturing evidence to get a surveillance warrant against an American citizen. Martha, that is not the FBI. I want your viewers to understand that is not the FBI that I worked with. It is not representative of 99.9% of the Bureau agents that I know. But they've got a problem. And if you're changing emails, manufacturing, altering evidence, which is a crime, because you want to get at somebody, you don't want them to be president of the United States, not only do you not have any business being an FBI agent or law enforcement, you probably ought to be wearing an orange jumpsuit.
I mean, the question is, why? Why would you change that? I mean, you know, even in the best case scenario, if you think, oh, maybe he's a double agent or something, aren't you going to sort of bring somebody in at the CIA and say, look, we're a little concerned about this guy? John Brennan was running the CIA at the time. Why didn't he reach out and protect his guy? Why didn't he say, hey, Carter Page, hold on. You're wrong about him. He's one of ours.
God knows he's on television enough. He's had ample opportunity when these all these interviews he gives about Trump ought to be in the dustbin in history and how treasonous he is. It would have been nice for him to stick up and say, hey, y'all are doing surveillance right now, reading the emails, intercepting the phone calls of someone that actually is working for the country as opposed to against the country. It'd been nice if he'd spoken up. He also denied in a congressional hearing that the dossier was used in any court pleading. So, look, those are the moral authorities that the left is citing.
You know, another question that I would have for Jim Comey, Chris Wallace is, I know, going to do a great interview. He's going to speak with him this weekend. Is this whole question of President Trump as a subject of their investigation? Because one of the things that we've spoken a lot about is the fact that the president was never given a heads up, not given a defensive briefing. The FBI says, oh, yes, we did, but it was really general. They weren't telling him that they were actually concerned that there were a couple people in his campaign that might be a problem. Now they're saying on page 55, Bill Priestap of this report says the reason we didn't tell candidate Trump when we talked to him and briefed him was because essentially we thought he was the subject of investigation. James Comey told him three times he was not a subject of investigation. How do you square that?
Well, when Devin and Paul and I went to the DOJ and we asked them that very question, did you give a defensive briefing to candidate Clinton? Did you give a defensive briefing to candidate Trump? The FBI's explanation was, yes, we gave one to candidate Trump, but because a target of our investigation, in this case Michael Flynn, was sitting right beside him, we couldn't give him the full exhaustive briefing we wanted to. So, of course, the follow-up question is, all right, well, the next day when you called him and said, we want to meet with you alone, or better yet, your former United States Attorney Chris Christie, who's on your campaign, we'd like to talk to him. What was the response then? They never went back, Martha. So
They clearly didn't want him to know.
But it's worse than that. They sent not a debriefing specialist. They sent an agent who was working on Crossfire Hurricane. They viewed it as the interrogation of a subject, not the defensive briefing of a candidate. So, again, I like Michael Horowitz. You know that. I've said it a million times. But if that's not a bias, that you would send an agent and not a defensive briefer, that you would not follow up and say, look, we need to talk to you, but we don't want anybody else around. I mean, if this is really about protecting the Trump campaign from Russia.
Protecting that you thought that they're, now they're, they keep saying, well, the next campaign's in so much trouble. We got to make sure we impeach the president right away. But when they had an opportunity to stop something that they were very concerned about, they let it roll and roll and roll. It wasn't happening, but they thought it was at that point. One other point I want to get to with you is this question of compromat, because everybody remembers this very scary thing that we were all told, that the president, because of this, you know, salacious, terrible, gossipy thing that happened supposedly at a Moscow hotel, that the Russians had that on the president and that he was compromised, and that if he became president of the United States, they were going to have something that they could hold over him, and that obviously would be very dangerous. Tell everybody where this little story came from.
It came from a conversation in a bar. I'll probably spent more time in bars than you have, but there are a lot of lies are told in bars. So this rumor, if it even rises to the level of a rumor, is repeated in a bar. The person who hears it doesn't even believe it. They just think it's just talk, just rumor mongering.
Jest, they said.
It is corroborated, according to the FBI, by none other than Sidney Blumenthal, because his reputation for authenticity and trustworthiness is just legendary. So that's Clinton's right and left hand corroborates this rumor, and it winds up being in a dossier. So enough that Comey briefed Trump on it. So when you get to the point that a conversation in a bar can be used as part of the federal government's filing in a court proceeding, and you take no efforts to go identify whether or not it's true, I've been around President Trump, he's a germ freak. The thing in the Moscow hotel, that ain't happening.
And when they went back to the subsource, they said, did you, you know, Steele put this in his report. Did you pass that along? And the source, according to the report, said he did.
Right. He didn't even believe it.
I didn't think he was going to put that in anything.
Right.
Why would he do that? Trey Gowdy, always good to see you.
Yes, ma'am.
To be continued. Thank you, sir.
What's coming up next is Representative Collins. he's grilling the counsel to intelligence committee, and they played games with these numbers and tried to subpoena and get these numbers and match them up with others. This is what this is about here. Listen to what Collins did. He went after this guy big time.
This is important because we just found out about this over the weekend. We got a massive document dump over the weekend preparing for this hearing in which the chairman admitted that, and the staff admitted they're not going to be able to read it all anyway. So for all of you writing reports about this, all that massive document dump, we're just simply going on a Schiff report, which Schiff refuses to come testify about, but sends his staff. So this is important stuff. We just found out about this. So how many subpoenas were issued to AT&T?
I don't know. If you'd like me to find
that's
out
fine.
During the break,
if you don't
I'd
know,
be happy
then,
to.
Then, again, maybe your chairman could be here to actually answer this. Was it targeted at a single telephone number or numbers?
We subpoenaed for call records multiple numbers.
How many?
I don't know. Very important, though. None of members of Congress, none of staff of Congress.
Oh, we're getting to that.
None of journalists.
We're getting to that.
We only did it to the subjects who were involved in the investigation, which is a very routine and standard investigative practice.
And you're not going to hear anything from me about a subpoena and the legality of a subpoena. My problem is this. Who on the committee asked that those numbers that you actually did put into for a subpoena and get those numbers back, who was it that asked that they be cross-checked for members of the media and members of Congress? Who ordered that?
I don't think that's how we did it, sir.
No, whoa. You came out with a report that actually showed these people, such as Mr. Chairman Nunez and others, were actually on these calls.
Yes.
Now, someone, and you and I, we're not going to play cute here. Somebody took the four records that you asked for, or at least four, took those numbers, and then said, hey, let's play match game. Who ordered the match game for members of Congress and the press? Was it you?
I don't think anyone did, sir.
Then how did you get... Yeah, okay, come on. That's the most ridiculous item I've ever heard. You don't just all of a sudden pick up numbers in which you have to match those numbers to actually show where they are, and you don't come up with them. Who ordered them to actually match for members of Congress and the press?
That's actually what you just described is exactly how it happened.
Who ordered to find out if Nunez's number was on those calls?
If I could just explain, sir. You pick an event of significance in the investigation, and you look for sequencing and patterns surrounding that event. You look then at the numbers, and you try to identify what those numbers are, and then you start to build the circumstantial case.
At this point, that's a wonderful explanation, but not an answer to my question. Those are you looking for the four numbers you asked for and to see how they're connected. I understand the subpoena that you issued. My question directly, was it you or was it Chairman Schiff that said, while we're doing this, let's see if this matches Chairman Nunez's number. Let's see if this matches a member of the press's number. Somebody along the way just didn't all of a sudden have an epiphany, unless you're getting ready to throw a low-level staffer under the bus, that these numbers might match. So who did it? Was it Chairman Schiff or was it you? Be careful. You're under oath.
I know I'm under oath, sir.
Then answer the question.
Matter. And I will answer the question, if you give me a second here. It's not a simple answer.
The same
answer.
Second that was not afforded to my witness, by the way.
Well, I think he was allowed to.
Who decided to leak it, by the way? If you're not going to tell me the other story, while you're thinking about how you're going to answer that question, who decided to leak it? The information. Why did you include it in the report?
That's not a leak, sir.
Why did you include it in the report? After not saying anything else about this, not publicly known. So two questions are hanging out that everybody's looking for an answer for, including me. Who ordered it? Was it you or was it Chairman Schiff? And then why was it decided, except for nothing but smear purposes, to be included in the Schiff report?
Well, I'm not going to get into the deliberations of our investigation with you. And I will tell you the reason it was included in the report is because the calls were surrounding important evidence to our investigation. And I think that your question is, frankly, not better directed not at me, but at the people who were having conversations.
Oh, no. We're not going to play that game. No, we're not going to play that game. You're as good as Mr. Burke. You're not going to play that game. You're not answering the question. And every member of the media, everybody here, when you start going into the decorum of this house, when you start looking at members' telephone numbers, you start looking at reporters' telephone numbers, which they ought to be scared about, you took a subpoena for four. And then you decided to play match game. You found numbers that you thought were like, some of them actually didn't exist because they claimed that they were for the White House budget office, and they were not. So we're throwing stories out there because nobody was out there acting. So I go back to my question. Are you going to go on record in front of everybody here today and say that you will not tell who ordered this? You or Mr. Goldman? Mr. Goldman, you or Mr. Schiff?
I am going to go on record and tell you that I'm not going to reveal how we conducted this investigation.
And that's the problem we have with this entire thing. Mr. Schiff said behind closed doors.
I can tell you what the importance is.
I'm done with you for right now. We're done.
God.
You're not answering the question. You're not being honest about this answer. Because you know who it is, you're just not answering. Ms. Gasser.
I have some information on the subpoenas.
Let's go.
We did receive copies of the subpoenas, and we tracked this. There were six, as I understand it. And then let me just say at the outset, our members have concerns about this exercise for three reasons. The subpoenas yielded information about members of Congress. Whether they're subpoenaed the members' phone records or not, it's a concern when the information yields.
Got to pay attention to this. Their counsel refused to answer who leaked and who actually worked on matching up all these numbers. And they were going after all fellow representatives. John Solomon got pulled into this. Giuliani. All these people, ungodly things. This thing is out of control, and we've got to get it back on track. I want to thank everyone for listening out there, and we certainly appreciate all of your support and your good wishes that you're giving us. Bye-bye.